And on What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Boston. I'm Paul Fisher.
You are tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. That was, the preceding was, What's the Frequency, Kenneth? And that was produced by CBS News longtime veteran Paul Fisher. Paul Fisher, also Pacifica Radio and WBAI alumni. Again, you're tuned to WBAI in New York. The time is exactly 11 p.m., and we hear next, in just a moment, Science, Health, and Healing with Dr. Majid Hatley. Please stay tuned.
Society for ethical.
Right, the machine has gone crazy and taken on a life of its own. Okay, let's try it again. Okay. No, come on. Oh, dear. Listen. Okay, we'll do it without the theme. Doc, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry. The computer has gone nuts and is playing everything.
Computers are not the only things which are going nuts these days.
Okay, you're listening to Science, Health, and Healing with Dr. Majid Ali. Doctor?
So, Sydney, thanks very much, my friend. I saw someone this last Tuesday, that was yesterday. She's a young woman, and she has a lot of difficulties for the last about over 10 years. So she has a heart palpitations, sweating, sometimes skipped heartbeats, which means sympathetic overdrive, fatigue, muscle pain, joint stiffness. She has problems of cognitive difficulties, mood, memory, mentation, some upper abdominal discomfort, heartburn, food just sits there. Abdominal bloating, diarrhea, constipation. History of yeast infection, oral thrush. She brought me her records. She was taking 11 different drugs. So I looked at her notes, and she had organized a thick pile of laboratory reports from previous doctors, neurologists, endocrinologists, internists. So after I looked at all that, I said, "What do you think is the problem?" She said, "Well, I prepared all these notes." I said, "Yes, I scanned them. What is your problem?" She looked at me somewhat puzzled. She said, "That's why I'm here, to find out. all the previous tests, the scans, the doctors, all the medications that I've been taking, nobody could really tell me what the problem is. I repeated my question. What do you think is the problem? She looked at me for a while, trying to figure out if I have a weird sense of humor, or I'm really so disconnected that I keep repeating my question. Finally, she spoke. She said, I'm inflamed. I said, did any of your doctors tell you that? She said, no. I said, how did you conclude that you are inflamed? She said, I just know that. I said, you are far, far more clear thinking than any of your doctors, if indeed, if it is true that none of your previous doctors told you that you are inflamed. She smiled for the first time and said, no, what I'm telling you is the truth. Nobody really told me, none of my doctors told me that I'm inflamed. I said, still, tell me, why do you think you are inflamed? She said, because that's what I feel. I said, what is it that you feel? Sore all over. I'm inflamed. I said, I'm going to repeat. You are far, far more clear-eyed about the basic problem that you have, the basic health problem, than any of your doctors. Because you reassure me that none of your previous doctors told you that you are inflamed. She gastroenterologist, she saw, they did endoscopy and they gave her Protonix. It's a drug like Nexium. Everybody knows Nexium because Nexium is the most heavily promoted acid blocker. GERD gastritis, I mentioned yesterday, is a form of fermentation in the stomach. Everybody knows Nexium because the company has the most money to advertise most heavily. But what does it mean to be inflamed? Inflammation is a term used, I was taught back in 1958, for some biochemical reactions. Today I would call them bioenergetic, to be more precise, to be more clear. Those biochemical reactions, in the terminology of 1958, which are included in the process of inflammation, are for the body to heal. So these are healing pathways. Classically, we were taught that inflammation means swelling, redness, tenderness, and pain. When somebody has a big red pimple on his face, acne. So there is redness, there is swelling, there is tenderness, and there is pain. So everybody would say, well, this is an acne pimple. And if you ask a pathologist, but what's the problem? He'll say, well, it's inflamed. The whiteheads that you see in acne are, of course, pus. Those of you who may want to look at the citations for all the statements that I'm making in this program. If you just Google oxygen model of inflammation, it will take you to an article that I published many years ago, and I give you all the citations. Those of you who want still more information, in the 11th volume of my textbook, I have a large chapter on inflammation. But I want to talk today, and I want to salute this young woman. She has the clear-eyed view of what her problem is. Her whole body is inflamed. But in today's language, our regular listeners know, but we always have people who are surfing the dial. Have you ever seen a commercial one way or the other which doesn't talk about anti-inflammatory or antioxidant? They have the best anti-inflammatory enzymes, the best anti-inflammatory spices, the best anti-inflammatory crystals. It all depends upon how much money the person has who is advertising. I think the best way to understand inflammation is it is those bioenergetic reactions without which no healing is possible. And when it becomes excessive, then the role of inflammation can be seen in every single chronic disease. That would be my 2013 view. And that article that I referred, Oxygen Model of Inflammation, traces certain historical events and puts it into the current model. This is my own view, that no chronic disease is possible without inflammation and no healing is possible without inflammation. So once you get this thing straight, then you want to know, what are those bioenergetic reactions that I'm talking about? So to the gross eye, what is visible by the gross eye, I mentioned, is swelling, pain, tenderness, and redness. The problem with this definition is, which unfortunately is still used by many doctors, that those criteria would completely fail in the case of this woman. This patient, this young woman, as I said, is far more clear-eyed than any of the other doctors. Because if you say that inflammation is a term for all those bioenergetic reactions which are necessary for all types of healing, and which can be demonstrated in all types of chronic diseases, then the old idea of looking at the redness, tenderness, but tender, her whole body is tender. Her whole body is a trigger point. You touch a muscle, joints, there's sensitivity. So the criteria of sensitivity and pain is there, except there's no redness. So a doctor listening to me would say, doesn't Dr. Ali really know that the four primary characteristics of the process of inflammation are redness, swelling, tenderness, and pain, and this patient was not red everywhere? But bioenergetically, inflammation means excess acidity. It means more free radical activity. It means thickening of bodily fluids, whether it is blood or lymph and the fluid that bathes the cells or the fluid that is inside the cells, those are secondary events. I hope that those of you who listen to this program forever would know, one, that no healing is possible without inflammation, so it's your friend, and two, that excessive inflammation is present in all chronic diseases. Why? Because this takes you to the next step, that inflammation means excess of acidity, excess of free radical activity, and thickening of the bodily fluids, which means that those fluids which are normally in circulation, for example, lymph or blood, they are not going to be flowing very well. And of course, when you put these three things together, excess acidity, excess free radical activity, and thickening of the bodily fluids, our regular listeners know that I introduced the term DysOx, D-Y-S-O-X, short for dysoxygenosis, which is not just mere absence or lack of oxygen. This is dysfunctional oxygen. Fundamentally, oxygen signaling is deranged. So what she felt, that one day there is more pain and stiffness on one's arm, and the other day it is on the other arm, and then it keeps moving. And then she has abdominal pain, and they say, well, you have irritable bowel syndrome. And 3 weeks later, a gastroenterologist puts an endoscope in her stomach and says, well, it's GERD and gastritis. And then somebody looks in her throat and says, well, you have thrush, which means overgrowth of yeast. And then, of course, she has been treated for vaginal yeast infections. It just goes on and on. Now, how do you explain on this God's green earth that a young person who had a very sharp mind, when she develops all these problems, she's fogged out? See, this is a very interesting concept. I have never heard a neurologist say that when a patient is fogged out, at a molecular level, there is buildup of acid, there's more free radical activities, there's a thickening of the body fluid, in one word, there's dysfunctional oxygen system in the brain cells. That's what brain fog is. But they don't say that because it's not in their textbooks. So every symptom that she had could be explained in a very simple way. Buildup of acidity, incremental free radical activity, thickness of the bodily fluid. See, when the muscles are all sore because they're loaded with acids, and acids irritate the nerves. Why is it important to have this broader pathologic perspective on inflammation? This is really an evolutionary view that inflammation is nature's trump card. The same processes without which no healing is possible will cause chronic disease if they are excessive, deranged, uncontrolled, unregulated. So now when she says, I am inflamed, she has set herself free from the tyranny of diagnostic labels, which change by the specialty of the doctor. Now at least she can think clearly. My problem is my cells are not breathing their own air. So they get loaded with acids because they can't burn food substances, sugars, protein, fats, to produce clean energy so they can continue to function and live, and when they're injured, to heal. It is so absurdly simple. So what you've done is you have shifted your focus from tyranny of diagnostic labels. You were disempowered because the doctors kept on changing the diagnostic label. Or somebody would say, come on, Dr. Ali, you know, this is hype. I made a diagnosis of gastritis and esophagitis, and I have a pathologist biopsy to prove that. I say, yes, 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 I know that, sir. Don't get carried away. I know that. But I know something that you don't. And that is the fermentation in the stomach that I have seen every single case started either with fermentation of the colon or fermentation of the mind. And that, sir, which you don't know because you're interested in pushing Nexium. you want to diagnose H. pylori so you can push antibiotics. Because you do not have a vocabulary of healing. Finally, this young woman, out of her suffering and despair, she got this insight that I got to change the vocabulary. I got to communicate with my tissues in a more clear way. I have to find the strength to dismiss their ideas of diseases and drugs. I'm through with this. So now she's saying, what do I have to do to get my cells to breathe? Whether they are in the heart pacemaker and the heart is beating faster and they're misskipped beats, or somebody might diagnose mitral prolapse. They love to diagnose that. Or it is GERD, or it is irritable bowel syndrome. Or it is irritable larynx syndrome. The other day I heard about that. Oh, I have irritable larynx syndrome. I said, why not? Why can't we have irritable right brain syndrome and irritable left brain syndrome? Irritable middle brain syndrome and irritable base of the brain syndrome. You understand I'm trying to really, yes, I am trying to insert that way of thinking. So I said to her, I said, you know, you're very clear. You have identified the problem. And now I will tell you what is happening in your body. It's not only that there is explosion of fermenting microbes in your colon and then in small intestine. And now somebody asked me to comment on our YouTube encyclopedia, Science, Health, and Healing. Dr. Ali, I'm beginning to hear a lot about small bowel, and so they have come up with a new disease. Some people will say, no, that's not a new disease. That's an old disease. SIBO, S-I-B-O, small intestinal bowel overgrowth. It doesn't occur to the geniuses who think about these diseases that small bowel is located between stomach on the top and colon on the bottom. So if there is fermentation in the small bowel, it can either be an extension from below of colon fermentation or extension from above of the stomach fermentation. But that's being ecologic in our thinking. That's being holistic in our conceptualization. But you can't make a career out of it. You want to be known as the world's greatest SIBO expert, S-I-B-O. So I said to her, I congratulate you that you now have the courage to think for yourself. Your body tissues have finally spoken it very eloquently. You're inflamed. And I explained to her what inflammation means. Just what I explained to you. Excess acidity, incremental free radical activity, thickening of the bodily fluids, increased viscosity of the bodily fluids. And all of that means dysfunctional oxygen metabolism, deranged oxygen signaling, impaired oxygen detergent function, blocked oxygen cellular detox functions, and weakened cellular repair functions. And all of those functions are of oxygen. So now we are going to say, what are these threats that the cells cannot breathe? Could there be something in the food? Something in the environment? Something in the stress? How interesting that in the gastroenterology literature, they never talk about the foods which will increase fermentation in the stomach. So the main points of this short program are, when you are not comfortable in any part of the body, please think inflammation. when you are inflamed, please think of excess acids, excess free radical activities, thickening of the bodily fluids. From that, you go to the next level of understanding. This is poisoning of the cells and their oxygen-driven systems. Now you are actually far, far more scientific. Any doctor who doesn't talk about oxygen in matters of understanding disease or how we heal, that doctor, the less I say about that doctor, the better I am. Let me tell you something interesting. Somebody, a very well-known professor, got a copy of my book, Oxygen and Aging, which came out in year 2000. He wrote me a letter. He said, I'm very intrigued about it. But there are things that you write about cellular pathology which are beyond my comprehension. How interesting. But this is not a criticism of that person. This is the whole system. Those who profit from disease literacy and drug literacy do not want people to become healing literate. That's the next point. So think inflammation, think acidity, think free radical activity, think thickening of the bodily fluids, think healing literacy, and set yourself free from owning your conditions. What is your condition? I have lupus. What is your condition? I have sarcoidosis. No, I have scleroderma. No, they said I have a mixed collagen disease except the new rheumatologist. Oh, no, it's rheumatoid arthritis. The old rheumatologist didn't have the foggiest idea of what was in the food and environments and thoughts which was causing inflammation in the joints, and neither does the new rheumatologist. They just love to change the diagnostic label. And who pays the price? Those gullible, innocent people who do not, somehow they are not exposed, that they have to think for themselves. There is no other alternative. Now you say, okay, what else can I do? Well, why don't you just Google my name and put turmeric on it? Why don't you just Google my name and put ginger on it? Why don't you put my name and put the word castor oil? Google my name, Ali, and castor oil. Google my name and sesame. Google my name and put flaxseed or lecithin. How about just calling it Dr. Ali's breakfast? How about calling it Dr. Ali's triple remedy, pain remedy, which is oil rubs, heat application, massage. So when your neck muscles feel like bricks, or you say, I carry this brick on my chest, I did a program last week about that. Small children now, 8 and 9 years old children now are coming up with this. I have chest pain, I'm short of breath, I have tightness of this, my heart beats faster, sometimes it skips a beat. I'm just talking about 8 or 9 years old. Things that I never knew existed. But the type of work that we do in integrative medicine, usually we can see these phenomena 15, 20, 25 years before the mainstream doctors do. As long as they continue to ignore oxygen, except when you are in ICU, and they say, oh, no, we give oxygen in intensive care. No, we give oxygen in emergency room. I'm not, sir, talking about your giving oxygen in emergency room. I'm talking about the lives of these young women which have been diminished by your mindless testing, this scan and that scan. But you cannot think about the basic design that you were taught back in medical school, first-year courses. But then, of course, when we are sick, we want to have the most expensive scan done. Rather than think about simple things that we can take care of, if we know what inflammation is, then we find out what are the good spices for inflammation. What are the pro-inflammatory foods? All sugary foods are pro-inflammatory. When you are sick like that, all fruits are pro-inflammatory. But it does mean that we have to take the time. So why don't you Google my name and pro-inflammatory foods, my name and insulin-friendly foods, my name and insulin-unfriendly foods. So either you do that, or welcome to the United States of America. One specialist after another specialist. Acute illness is always an exception. I always want to make that point. In acute illness, you need the attention of experienced doctors, proper technology, nurses, hospitals. But if you are sick for years and you keep shopping with these specialists, then frankly, you have to hold yourself responsible for it. You are looking for that rare disease that nobody can diagnose? Well, what kind of a pathologic satisfaction is it that you suffer for 5-10 years and then you announce at a dinner table just to impress everyone, oh, finally I went to this and this and this doctor and he's the greatest doctor and he finally found this carrot in the freezer syndrome, call it, or monkey in the bathtub syndrome. Why not? Everybody else makes syndromes. Why can't I make syndromes? So please think healing. Please think inflammation. Please think oxygen. Please learn about anti-inflammatory foods, anti-inflammatory spices. Anger and frustration is pro-inflammatory. So you need to find something about, you know, I have a course on Ali Academy. This is the last thing I'm going to mention tonight. There's a course, if you go on aliacademy.org, I have a course on seminar. Seminar number 3 and number 4 are devoted to this concept of beware living when you live a life of other people's script, or be aware living when you learn to live your life your way, your life script. You delineate it, you define it, you live it. There are simple things you can do. The power of a moldy leaf, the power of a cigarette butt on the sidewalk, the power of a pigeon or a squirrel or a bird or a beast or a bug, those things are not important. What is important is these little items can help you breathe your own air and live your own life, the life of beware living. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Life of be aware living. Otherwise, we are doomed to live the beware mode of living where somebody on television decides what the script of our life should be and how we should live it. And of course, they reap the profit from those that way of thinking, and we suffer. This has been Science, Health, and Healing. Please join me again next Tuesday at 11 o'clock. Until then, please go to aliacademy.org, invest your time, look at these materials, learn these practical things, and until we meet again, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
And you're tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org. And the preceding program, Science, Health, and Healing, supports you live. Time is 11:32, 2 minutes behind schedule. And we hear next a rebroadcast of the WBAI Evening News. Please stay tuned.
Good evening. In the news tonight, an NYPD supervisor changes his testimony several times at the stop and frisk trial. Union leaders want to know why City Hall is freezing them out of jobs at a New York City park. And the Supreme Court deals a major blow to the victims of international human rights abuses. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Wednesday, April 17th, 2013.
Order. Members and Bagheri, can I just ask that you refrain from any comment? There will be a waiata after the clerk has announced the third reading, but I just ask so that we can get the procedures of the House completed. Members, the ayes are 77, the noes are 44.
Cheers rocked the New Zealand Parliament today when the vote approving the Marriage Amendment Bill, legalizing same-sex marriage, was announced following its third reading. The bill has the support of Prime Minister John Key. This makes New Zealand the 13th nation in the world and the first in the Asian Pacific region to approve marriage equality for lesbian and gay couples.
Marriage definition of Marriage Amendment Bill, third reading.
Now I understand.
As the applause died down, spectators in the packed balcony and members of Parliament joined together in singing a love song in the language of the indigenous Maori people of New Zealand. Australian news sources are reporting that more than 1,000 Australian same-sex couples are planning to travel to New Zealand to get married. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard says she is opposed to gay marriage. The first same-sex marriage licenses won't be issued in New Zealand until August, giving the country's Department of Internal Affairs ample time to prepare license forms and procedures. In Washington today, the Senate defeated several gun-related measures. In rapid succession, they voted down a bipartisan compromise to expand background checks for would-be gun purchasers, a ban on assault weapons, and a ban on high-capacity gun magazines. All failed to get the 60 votes needed under an agreement both parties had reached to consider the amendments. Senators also turned back Republican proposals to promote concealed weapons permits nationally and focus law enforcement on prosecuting gun crimes. Among those looking on from the gallery, Lori Haas, whose daughter was shot at Virginia Tech, and Patricia Mache, a survivor of the mass shooting in Tucson, shouted, "Shame on you." Vice President Joe Biden, who presides over the Senate, then asked for decorum. A Boston politician says investigators poring over photos and videos from the Boston Marathon bombing have an image of a man dropping off a bag containing one of the bombs. City Council President Stephen Murphy said today that investigators saw the image on surveillance footage they got from a nearby department store. He says he doesn't know if investigators have identified the man. Murphy says police officers involved in the probe say investigators have matched information from the intelligence footage with witness descriptions of someone leaving the scene. Murphy says officers are chasing leads that could take them to the man. He says developing that information within the first 48 hours of the probe is a major breakthrough. Opponents and supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline are preparing to face off in Nebraska once again, but a new route for the project has helped reduce some local opposition. Both sides will speak on the pipeline Thursday during a U.S. State Department hearing in Grand Island. The public forum comes before the department makes a recommendation to President Barack Obama on whether to build the $7.6 billion Canada to Texas pipeline. National opponents have formed a new group, the All Risk, No Reward Coalition, which recently ran television ads in a dozen major media markets. The group planned to air the ads Tuesday in Nebraska, but local officials in several towns along the route say the pipeline no longer registers as a major concern. This is week 5 of the stop and frisk trial, Floyd versus the City of New York. The landmark civil rights lawsuit challenges the legality of the police tactic as a violation of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures, and of the 14th Amendment's protections against racially discriminatory policing. WBAI's Linda Perry has been following the trial. She files this report.
A man has his hands in his pockets. It's a cold evening. He's going from his mom's house to his own home close by. He crosses the street. He's in Jamaica, Queens, walking between cars, about to reach one of those wide mediums at a boulevard. He's a middle-aged man. His name is Cornelia McDonald. His skin color is black. He's wearing his winter coat. It's dark out. It's after 1 a.m. This is when plainclothes police in an unmarked van pull up to McDonald. They get out and stop and frisk him. CPW is what's written in the stopping officer's memo book. CPW, criminal possession of a weapon. The NYPD officer, Edward French, put his hands into McDonald's pocket and pulls out a cell phone. French fills out a UF-250, the form used by NYPD officers to record circumstances of stops. These forms are supposed to show reasonable suspicion for a stop, but the officer only checks off one box on the form, suspicious bulge. Hands in pocket, cold December evening, suspicious bulge is the rationale for the stop. The cops didn't find a gun, no drugs, just a man walking home from his mom's in a public housing complex. The officer's supervisor, Michael Lorry, testifies. He changes his testimony several times. Jonathan Moore is attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Sometimes you make, you know, the typographical errors in your deposition, or, you know, that a word is that could have two meanings is written the wrong way. But he's changed his answers from yes to no, to I recall, to I don't recall. I mean, it's
shocking.
Shocking, yeah. I have other adjectives I could use, but I won't go there. Let me just say that it's outrageous that somebody would get up only 2 months after testifying and change all his answers to the most important questions that he was asked at the deposition.
Now, this is after he talks to the city.
This is after he talked to the city, and after the city, and after we represented to the city in open court why we thought he was important. So.
And how did it change his testimony? Tell listeners.
Well, at his deposition, he said, for instance, you can't tell whether there's reasonable suspicion from looking at a 250 form. That's kind of an important issue in this case, because we're saying you have forms that aren't good for anything. All they do is they just check off boxes. He's now saying, oh, now you could do that. So that's a substantial material change. That's not just a typographical error. That's changing his entire testimony.
And also, the check boxes on the 250s, most people said you're supposed to have more than one check for it to be reasonable suspicion,
right.
But he said no.
Well, that's the other thing. At first he said yes, and then he said no. So, you know, this is the kind of testimony where if you were talking to a jury, you would say, you can't believe anything he's saying. Throw it all out, you know. But the important point is, he's supposed to be doing the right thing. He's the sergeant supervising these officers, and he's not doing it. And then when he getting up after having testified one way, gets up at trial and testifies the other way, it's even worse than his lack of supervision. It's a lack of credibility, a lack of integrity.
But quite frankly, how often do we have to hear this? This has been not the first time that someone's changed their testimony.
Right. Well, and that's an important question, because it really, well, how much, you know, we've already heard that. How often, how much more do we have to hear it? We have the burden, and we're asking the court to do a pretty extraordinary thing, which is to impose an injunction on the police department of the city of New York to try to remedy this crime wave of stop and frisks. That's a heavy burden. So we have to make sure the record is complete, is sufficient enough to justify that, not only for Judge Shinlin, but more importantly for the Second Circuit, who is going to be asked to review this, because for sure the city will appeal whatever she does.
An integrity control officer takes the stand. His name, Lieutenant Cosmo Palmieri. His job is to monitor police abuse. He says the main part of his job is to watch overtime. He spends some time reviewing officers' memo books. He visits some officers on foot posts. But at the end of his testimony, he clearly states that he hasn't had an opportunity to monitor an officer to make sure they are complying with stop and frisk policies. Moore says this is the root of the problem.
What you're seeing now, and it's a bit tedious, but what you're seeing now is a disconnect between what the bosses say they're doing and should be doing, and what the training says they should be doing, and what is actually happening on the street. You know, this is not when Esposito testified, when Deputy Inspector Ortiz testified, they talk about how great the supervision system is, but in reality, it's not there. And here you have the integrity control officer, the aptly named integrity control officer, to make sure that the officers are complying with the law, who doesn't care about any of this. He doesn't do any investigation of any stop and frisk, any Roshi profiling, nothing. The failure to document in memo books, it's just not there. So it's the essence of what this case is. At the heart of it, it's the lack of supervision and monitoring that is not taking place in the NYPD that leads people like Officer French and Sergeant Loria to just stop people because they have their hands in their pocket because it's December and it's winter and they're walking home.
The Center for Constitutional Rights continues to present their case through next week. Then it's the city's turn. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Municipal unions were at City Hall today demanding to know how the Bloomberg administration has let a private art show use a public park and hire out-of-state workers. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
They're looking to knock the unions out, charge the same price as if they had unions there, but not use us. And we live here. We pay $14 tolls. We pay $30 to park our cars. It's really, come on. Come on, really. Something's going on here, and it ain't right.
John from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Union, one of many union workers and representatives on the steps of City Hall today, calling on the Bloomberg administration to explain how a foreign art show comes to the city, uses a public park for a private art show, and hires workers from out of state for tent and exhibition construction. John had a colourful term for the practice. He called it flesh peddling. What's happening is the London-based Frieze is bringing their art show to Randall's Island in early May, where for a week they'll feature works from more than 1,000 artists from around the world. For City Council member Melissa Mark Vivarito, Randall's Island falls within her district.
This is a 10-year contract with the City of New York, and we are asking for intervention on behalf of the mayor's office to sit down and try to renegotiate the arrangement. There also has been communication from the Speaker's office trying to get Frieze to sit at the table. There seems to be a hesitancy on their part to negotiate and to sit. But this, we have to understand that, you know, Randall's Island is public parkland. This is parkland that now is going to be offline for close to 2 months for this private event, which probably most of the members of my community, which it belongs to Randall's Island, probably won't be able to access because I'm sure the admission fee is going to be way too high. So again, we are giving a public resource for a private event. And so for them to then now add insult to injury by not providing local jobs, by trying to skirt and not provide quality jobs, union jobs, to our local residents in New York City, and that the mayor's office is okay with that, that's not acceptable. So we're trying to put pressure, come together, and make sure that it is known that we want this contract to be altered and we want local residents to benefit and to get these jobs.
Unions contend Frieze New York and their local event coordinator, Production Glue LLC, discriminates against New York City's union workers. George Miranda is the president of Joint Council 16, whose members perform all of the jobs in the exhibition industry.
It is an absolute insult that for the second year in a row, Frieze Art New York and its management agent, Production Glue, have purposely avoided union labor. And that does not go unnoticed by us. Since 2007, Production Clue has been the coordinator of many of the events for the mayor's office of special projects and community events. Production Clue has benefited from our tax dollars and enjoyed lucrative careers on the backs of our citizens. The tenting alone at Frieze New York requires more than 100 tractor trailers, with the total number of trucks used to transport all of the production components approaching 1,400 trucks. Last year, the tent at Frieze New York took 6 to 7 weeks with about 500 workers on site daily. The tent is the size of 3 football fields. In 2012, a junior art handler working at Frieze for Production Glue reported earning $17 an hour with no benefits. Workers have been recruited from as far away as Wisconsin to work here at Randall's Island. Of course, we don't have any workers here, so that's why we go to Wisconsin to get the workers that we need.
This is the second time the Freeze Art Fair is happening. Kevin Kerrigan, president of 829, Exhibition Employers Union, and a working president, said they picketed the fair last year.
We were made aware of the situation. We went out there, we picketed. You know, it's our right as union members to do that, to picket. And we weren't accepted graciously out there. We were actually we were removed off the premises.
This is public land.
Yes. This is public land, correct. And last year we were asked.
Who?
We were moved. I mean, it's the, I would say the community service, the police department, the community affairs. The police officer came down and said that we had to move and we weren't allowed to picket there. So first we had we were using whistles and we were using noisemakers, and then that was eliminated, and then we went down to just whistles and that was eliminated. And then the day before the opening, when Mr. Bloomberg was going to go down and have the ribbon cutting service, so we were asked to move the premises altogether. So we have to go and find these shows. And I mean, my union does have the jurisdiction. We have a 100-mile jurisdiction radius in New York City. And it's a matter of going out and finding them and either working it out with the prospective show managers and decorators. And most times we're accepted. I mean, I said it's 50-50. Most times we're accepted. Sometimes there are challenges there that we have to get by. But for the most part, like I said, Local 807, Local 829, Local 1, Eddie McMahon, Local 817, we're basically all involved in the stagehand productions in New York City. And again, we have the jurisdiction. I'm not asking for anything that we're not entitled to. And when it comes to the free show, I'm not asking for all of us to go to work there and take over 500 jobs. This year going forward, let me have a piece of the pie. All I'm asking for is a slice of life. That's all I'm asking for.
A slice of life. Elected officials joining Melissa Mark-Viverito were Mark Weprin and Jessica Lappin, who say if a company is going to use a taxpayer park, it should be guaranteeing local jobs and fair labor standards. Discussions are underway to change the city permitting rules for major events to better serve labor standards. For WBAI's Evening News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
The U.S. Supreme Court today unanimously ruled to block a lawsuit filed by Nigerians charging Shell Oil with complicity in torture, murder, and extrajudicial executions committed by the Nigerian government. The case, called Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, was filed on behalf of the late Dr. Barnum Kiobel and several other Nigerians, including writer and environmental activist Ken Sarawiwa, from the Ogoni region of the Niger Delta. They had been detained on spurious charges, held incommunicado in military custody, tortured, then tried by a special court under procedures that did not meet international legal standards. In November 1995, they were found guilty and executed. The plaintiffs in the Supreme Court case, supported by amicus briefs filed by the United States, international human rights organizations, and international legal scholars, said Shell had participated in bribing witnesses to give false testimony in the Nigerian Special Tribunal. The lawsuit was filed under the Alien Torts Statute, a law that has been used for decades to hold human rights abusers accountable in U.S. courts. Raha Walla, a senior counsel with Human Rights First, says today's Supreme Court ruling is really a tragedy.
It effectively closes the door on a large number of international human rights cases that have been available under the Alien Tort Statute for the last 30 years. So we're really disappointed that the Supreme Court has gone in this direction of denying victims of human rights abuses their day in court.
The ruling denying the Nigerian plaintiffs their case in court was unanimous. What was the general thrust of that ruling? Why did all nine justices rule against allowing Nigeria to go forward?
In essence, what the court said was that the Alien Tort Statute, the federal law in this case, should not be given a presumption that it applies extraterritorially, that is, outside of the United States. And because the alleged facts here involved corporations that were acting on Nigerian soil outside of the United States, therefore the law would not be presumed to apply outside of the United States to acts that occurred in Nigeria.
This is a statute that's over 200 years old, and it's only come into use in the last 30 years. But what was the original intent of this law?
Well, the law is designed to provide foreign nationals with a right to sue in federal courts for what's called violations of the laws of nations. And that's a term that had not really been defined, but was originally intended to apply to acts that were considered universal crimes, like piracy or attacks against ambassadors. Now, in the last 30 years, it's been generally accepted, including in U.S. courts and by the Supreme Court, that the law would also apply to universal human rights violations, such as torture or slavery or other kinds of human rights violations. And I think that's what's so shocking here, is that the court has really kind of reversed the last 30 years of jurisprudence that clearly has established that this law would be available to victims of human rights violations.
There was a split on the extent of the ruling. The four more liberal judges on the court tried to keep the door at least partially open for such lawsuits. What was different about their take?
Well, their position was, hey, let's wait a little bit here and decide based on the facts of every particular case, rather than having a categorical judgment that says that the law should not apply to any acts that are committed in a foreign country. And essentially what they were saying was that as long as there's some kind of concrete connection to U.S. interests or U.S. territory, then we may be able to see a situation in which this law actually could apply extraterritorially to acts on a foreign soil. Now, they didn't go out to spell in a lot of detail what that would mean, but it's safe to say that they had in mind an intention to preserve the law in a wider category of situations than the majority on the court did.
This case is very similar to the case Sarawiwa versus Royal Dutch Shell. What are the differences between this and the Sarawiwa case that was settled 4 years ago for more than $15 million? Were the circumstances of those two cases similar?
They were very similar. I mean, in both situations, you had a foreign corporation that allegedly was involved in gross human rights abuses, including torture, with foreign governments on foreign soils with foreign plaintiffs. So that's one of the big problems that really bothered the court in this case, where the court essentially said, what business do U.S. courts have pronouncing judgment on essentially foreign situations that are happening with foreign plaintiffs in another country? It's a bit of a travesty because for many of these plaintiffs, these victims of human rights abuses, this is really their last shot at justice. They're not able to get redress in the courts in their home countries. And so U.S. courts need to be available to be a venue of last resort for individuals who are seeking justice for human rights abuses.
There are some crimes that have universal jurisdiction, specifically crimes against the Convention Against Torture, which the United States is a signatory to. Do the plaintiffs in this case, or plaintiffs who are similarly situated, have any recourse under international law to pursue this case?
Well, it remains to be seen. Unfortunately, as it currently stands, with some minor exceptions, violations of international law and international human rights law in particular are enforced through the domestic courts of particular countries, either the home countries in which these foreign nationals live or other countries who have jurisdiction, oftentimes universal jurisdiction, and are willing to execute that international law. So when you have a situation where we're alleging torture or extrajudicial killing, such as the current case in Kyobo, it's widely accepted that there's universal jurisdiction so that any country who has ability to bring the case in their courts should have the responsibility to take that case forward. So it's unclear as to whether there'll be any further redress for these particular victims, but certainly I hope that other countries beyond the United States would consider taking these cases on.
Does today's ruling effectively close the door on cases such as those that have been successful under the Alien Torts Claims Act for torture and abuse committed in other countries?
You know, we don't know. It certainly goes a long way towards closing the door. But there was a really interesting concurrence by Justice Kennedy, who is in many ways seen as the swing vote in these cases, where Justice Kennedy essentially said that the court had left open a number of important questions about the scope and application of the Alien Tort Statute. That's the federal law here. And so what we'll see is in future cases, there will be some litigation, some testing as to exactly how much of a connection to the United States these cases need to have before the Supreme Court will be willing to entertain these cases.
Rahawala is a senior counsel with Human Rights First, based in Washington, D.C. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
I'm Harry Allen. This is Nonfiction. And Nonfiction is the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact, airing every Friday, 2 to 3 p.m. over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Tune in for a wide range of compelling topics, informed guests, and penetrating interviews. That's Fridays, 2 to 3 p.m., Nonfiction over WBAI New York. WBAI.org.
Today on 5 o'clock Shadow, a very special tribute to the late, great, and dearly departed Maggie Thatcher. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This week witnesses the London funeral of the controversially conservative former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who succumbed recently to heart disease following a years-long bout with dementia. Thatcher earned two main honorifics stemming from her leadership heyday in the 1980s. She was named a Baroness in 1992, but also dubbed the Iron Lady by Red Star journalist Yuri Gavrilov for her fierce opposition to the Soviet Union and socialism and her propensity for corporate favors, union busting, and domestic austerity.
There is no doubt that the Prime Minister has in many ways achieved substantial success. There is one statistic that I understand is not, however, challengeable, and that is that over her 11 years, the gap between the richest 10% and the poorest 10% in this country has widened substantially. How can she say at the end of her chapter of British politics that she can justify many people in a constituency such as mine being relatively much poorer off, much less well-housed, and much less well-provided than it was in 1979. Surely she accepts that is not a record that she or any Prime Minister can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, all levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the Honourable Member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy. Yes, it came out. He didn't intend intended to, but he did.
I give way to the honourable gentleman.
I'm extremely grateful. The Prime Minister is aware that I detest every single one of her domestic policies and have never had that.
I think that the honourable gentleman knows that I have the same contempt for his socialist policies as the people of East Europe who have experienced it have it for that. I think I must have hit the right nail on the head when I pointed out that the logic of those policies are they'd rather have the poor poorer. Once they start to talk about the gap, they'd rather the gap were that. Down here. Democracy that way.
On the global stage, Thatcher is perhaps most famous for her invasion of the Argentine Malvinas Islands, considered by the United Kingdom to be one of its colonial possessions. Thatcher dispatched tens of thousands of British troops to the South Polar region to reclaim the so-called Falkland Territory from an Argentine attack and reoccupation. London-based Sky News covered the invasion in favorable terms.
What's your reaction,
Just rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces and the Marines.
She might have been doubted in public and in private, but now we know that Margaret Thatcher's determination to retake the Falkland Islands never wavered. But the Falklands archives reveal an honest, rare admission from her. I just say it was the worst, I think, moment of my life. As British forces prepared for the decisive Battle of Stanley, she took a call in Downing Street. It was just before midnight in London. On the line from Washington was President Reagan. He had a plea, a final request for diplomacy. It fell on deaf ears. As Britain had had to go into the islands alone with no outside help, she could not now let the invader gain from his aggression, an official Downing Street log of the conversation reveals. She had lost valuable British ships and invaluable British lives. The relationship between the American and British leaders, which was genuinely special, was being strained.
We see Mrs. Thatcher's total conviction, her total grip and grasp on government. I think at this time she was listening more than perhaps at any other stage during her premiership, listening to expert advice and acting on it.
Realisation in London that some British ships had been damaged or destroyed by French-made Exocet missiles owned by the Argentinians sent the government into something close to panic. Thatcher sent a fuming telegram to François Mitterrand demanding a planned shipment of Exocets to Peru be delayed or else. As you yourself agreed, there can be no doubt that Peru will pass them, the missiles, onto Argentina, she wrote. This would have a devastating effect on the relationship between our two countries. The threat worked.
The American president at the time of the first British invasion of the Americas since 1812, Ronald Reagan, looked the other way in violation of the hemispheric compact known as the Rio Treaty, which bans European invasions of the Western Hemisphere. Nevertheless, Reagan and Thatcher became the poster children of 1980s social conservatism and global militarism.
The government which I lead has been in power now for just over half a year. We face great difficulties, some of them deep-seated and long-standing, and some stemming from beyond our shores. And I don't pretend that anything's going to be remedied immediately. But we are determined upon a change. We're determined to return to the first principles which has traditionally governed our political and economic life, namely, the overall responsibility of the individual rather than the state for his own welfare, and the paramountcy of Parliament for the protection of fundamental rights. The government I lead has a resounding mandate to restore the faith and the fortunes of the nation. We shall stick at the task, whatever the difficulties and however great the endurance required. And we shall do so, Mr. President, in the conviction that our allies across the Atlantic have confidence in us, just as we have confidence in the strength and ingenuity of the United States to meet any challenge and triumph over any adversity that confronts them.
One of the most bitter legacies of Margaret Thatcher is her prosecution of a dirty war against Irish patriots of the six counties of Northern Ireland, which had become a de facto English colony. Thatcher sanctioned assassinations against nationalist dissidents and members of the IRA with a ferocity equal to the Malvinas invasion. Former parliamentarian and Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams said this week that neither history nor Ireland will well countenance Thatcher's legacy.
Margaret Thatcher, in her terms as British Prime Minister, did great hurt to people in Britain, to working class communities across Britain, but also to people here in Ireland. Most Republicans and Nationalists will remember, and maybe many others, her for the shameful role she played during the epic hunger strikes in 1980 and 1981. And how she pursued a draconian policy of militarism, embraced collusion, authorized the killing of citizens, both in overt and covert operations. Even though, in marked contradiction to her public posturing, she opened up a back channel of communication with Sinn Féin. She failed to act on the logic.
Irish-American antipathy to Thatcher was expressed even more vividly this week at a People's Wake for Maggie Thatcher, hosted by John McDonough of WBAI's Radio Free Erin at the Irish pub Rocky Sullivan's in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
We're turning out for the Irish Wake for Margaret Thatcher now. It has been Margaret Thatcher that has brought us together, but we're really here to remember the victims and not remember her. And if we do remember her, it's her policies. So we want to remember the coal miners that went out on strike, led by Arthur Scargill, and how some of them were killed and shot with plastic bullets. We also want to remember the 323 sailors that were killed on the Belgrano in neutral waters by Margaret Thatcher during the Malvinas War. Remember, it's not the Falklands, it was the Malvinas War. And I want to thank the people that are in here from Argentina tonight that came down, and how she was not brought up on war crimes. It's beyond me, but they never seem to do in the Western countries. And particularly, being this is an Irish bar, we want to remember the 10 hunger strikers who died on hunger strike because of the intransigence of Margaret Thatcher. And one person, if you were in New York in 1981, and were at the demonstrations at the British Council, you know there was huge crowds there with the mock coffins, and then the march that went down 2nd Avenue, where you made a left onto 47th Street into Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, where there was a flatbed truck, and one person that was always there for all the funerals, and that was Father Pat Maloney. And I want to introduce the saint of the Lower East Side, Father Pat Maloney.
May I first ask you to have just a moment of silence in memory of the glorious 10, the men, Bobby Sands and his glorious companions, who were ruthlessly murdered after a long life of torture by the Butcher of London, known as the Iron Lady. May God grant glory to our glorious martyrs. But let us remember, they speak about the Iron Lady. Iron, there was nothing iron about her. She was sullied, dirty, stained steel, with a heart of steel, a heart that allowed 10 vibrant young Irish men die slowly the torturous death of hunger strike. She was the woman who denied our Irish men the right to human dignity and the status of political prisoners. And let us look back for a moment. If a man is a common criminal in any country of the world, he's given a fair trial, at least a jury of his peers, and can call witnesses on his behalf. But our men were picked off the street, lifted is the word they used back in the occupied zone, dumped into not prisons, but internment camps, not allowed the opportunity to challenge witnesses on the very word of the special branch, or even in the south, but in the north, the B specials and the others, on their very word, these men were interred and tortured. I'd like to read to you from the words of Bobby Sands a few lines. It is frightening to see men become aged at 18 and 19. Young men who are fit and strong in mind and body a year ago now resemble shrunken skulls of human beings. Every aspect of the H-block life, from cold, empty cells and denial of every comfort, to refusal of medical treatment, is designated to grind down our resistance. But it will not succeed. They may hold our bodies in the most inhuman conditions, but while our minds remain free, our victory is assured. That was from Bobby Sands while languishing in his prison cell. Now we can look at the hunger strikers for a moment, but imagine the torture of the mothers who lost sons, the wives who lost husbands, the children who lost their parents, and all because they asked to be recognized for who they were. The freedom fighters of Ireland, attempting to finish what had started in 1916. Thatcher was a butcher in the same lineage of Lloyd George, who, after the Civil War, threatened that if we did not sign the treaty, they would annihilate our nation. And our men had no choice. Some of them, but not all, including my father of blessed memory, did not lay down their arms. They hid them until another day would come. And then we had followed, of course, Churchill. Another one they lauded as a great man. And Churchill threatened the then Taoiseach of Ireland and said, if you do not give up your ports and support Britain, they threatened us again. Again, without much success. Now we can roll history on to the time of Maggie Thatcher. And as was mentioned before, when the Belgrado was sailing away, after it had agreed to leave the Malvinas, Argentina, she blew them out of the water, leaving Argentine women without husbands, children without fathers. Then, when good, honest, decent British citizens from the different colonies reached the time that they could come back to Mother England to look for prosperity, British citizens bearing British passports, they became indentured servants, similar to slaves in their so-called motherland. And when they went in the streets in peaceful protest, Thatcher referred to them as thugs, thugs, thugs. We can refer back to her as murderous, murderous, murderous. That's who she was. Now, it might sound strange and maybe a little contradictory that a Catholic priest should speak so vehemently and strongly. But when you look into the eyes of the mothers of some of the hunger strikers, I had the great privilege of doing the mass, the 10th anniversary of the hunger strike, in St. Patrick's Cathedral. Members of the Sands family and members of other hunger strike families were there. The pain was still there, and I'm sure those who are still living, that pain continues forever. This was the pain inflicted by the woman that the Queen of England should call a lady. By the longest shot of the imagination, you could not call this woman a lady. She was ruthless. But then again, the gospel tells us we must forgive. But remember, forgiveness is not unconditional. Forgiveness is based on the willingness to say I'm sorry, to repent, and to make restitution. Thatcher never made any even attempt to apologize or say sorry to the Irish people. And unfortunately, in today's Ireland, there are those who have bowed to her and maybe shake hands with the Queen that backed her up. That's a different story. Far be it for me to get into politics. But however, well, the uprising in England showed how she treated her own people. I'd like to make something crystal clear. I have never been anti-English, only British and English policy. English, as Sean McBride had said one time, the great statesman, when it came to dealing with the Irish, the English had a totally different view, a totally different morality. We were considered subhuman. So we have to take all that into consideration in seeing and asking ourselves, who was Maggie Thatcher? Let me again, Bobby Sands would like to speak to you from his throne in heaven. There's a beautiful poem he wrote called Poetic Justice. It was the strangest dream, sure enough, of all I've ever had. I dreamt I'd left this life, and to be honest, I was glad. And so I felt my soul ascending. I looked down to whence I came, and all I saw was nakedness, suffering, and pain. I proceeded farther. When we reached the golden gate, where the Lord sat on his throne, and Peter called upon me to come to show them alone. Bob, said the Lord, you've done all right down there. Of torture, pain, and suffering, don't I know you had your share? Let him in, Peter, said the Lord, and go in peace, my son, for the Lord your God forgives you and everything you have done. Well, I was a happy soul, for the good Lord had forgiven all. I was just about to collect my wings when I heard Roy get his call. Mason Lord, said Peter, I think you know him well, and by his color of his soul, he has plenty to tell. Peace be with you, Lord, said Roy. And now, the same Lord is saying to Thatcher, peace to you. Have you anything to confess? Yes, Lord, Thatcher said. You must believe me. It was Cromwell that made the mess, and Merlin, Rees, and Winslow. They led me far astray. Lord, what else could I have done there? I could find no other way. That's what probably Maggie is saying before the throne of the Lord tonight. She's probably copying a plea. She's probably saying what the Nazis said at Nuremberg. I did my duty. I served my king and empire, my queen and empire, a blood-stained, ruthless, vicious empire that thought nothing but the glory of the crown and their own, filling their own coffers and their safes with the gold of the world. And what about H Block, the Lord said to Maggie, and all those naked men you kept? Don't you know, said the Lord, I watched them, and every night they wept. You tortured them, and you held them all those years, naked and suffering. They wept a million tears. What is to be done, said Peter? My Lord, you must contrive. Poetic justice, Peter, said the Lord. And to Thatcher, send her down to the H Block 5. As a priest of the Catholic Church, I must say, may God have mercy on her soul. May God deliver us all from the evil that such people can perpetrate throughout the world. I think it might have been Voltaire who said, such people are belched out from the depths of hell on the eve of perdition. Hitler would have been one of them. Thatcher would have been another. And there would be others that we are not here to speak about tonight. I appeal to you, good people here, remember, in 1916, a handful rose against the evil empire. And as long as there are even a few good men and women willing to stand up for the cause of justice and freedom, the likes of Thatcher will not have prevailed. They will prevail if we continue to banter with and play with the British. They've broken every treaty they've ever made with us. Now, I am not indeed an advocate of the return to the bomb or the bullet. I believe sincerely in the just war of defense, should that ever happen. But 3 years from now, as you know, we will celebrate the glorious 100th anniversary of the Irish uprising, the revolution, not just a rebellion, not a rising. It was a revolution in which the men and women of Ireland revolted against the tyranny of the most evil empire that ever ruled the world. It is our responsibility to see that the sacrifices of Bobby Sands and his men be not in vain. It's our responsibility to hope and pray for an Ireland united and free, a 32-county country. And remember the words of Thatcher. I close with these. They were, out, out, out. I fully agree with her. Out, Thatcher, out, Queen, out, all of you who do not believe belong on the soil of Ireland. May God love and bless you all.
But somebody just came up to me with an English accent. She says, can I say something? I said, about who? She said, Thatcher. So she promised me a couple of seconds.
I have the slightly opposing view about her death in that I wish she'd lived to be 115, lonely, demented, covered in bed sores. But you can't always get what you want. Even her children hate her. Her daughter is crazy and her son is a crook. So see what her loins have spawned. This is a woman who said there's no such thing as society. You know, is there anything more you can say after that? So anyway, I'm happy to celebrate the passing of this devil woman with all of you. And I did live under the tyranny of this witch, so I understand what it was. That's all.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Meanwhile, across the pond in London, Thatcher's legacy was also being critically assessed by parliamentarian Glenda Jackson, the former Oscar-winning best actress in Women in Love and A Touch of Class.
Glenda Jackson.
Mr. Deputy, Mr. Speaker, when I made my maiden speech all in this chamber a little over 2 decades ago, Margaret Thatcher had been elevated to the other place, but Thatcherism was still reeking as it had reeked for the previous decade, the most heinous social, economic and spiritual damage upon this country, upon my constituency and my constituents. Our local hospitals were running on empty. Patients were staying on trolleys in corridors. I tremble to think what the death rate for pensioners would have been this winter if that version of Thatcherism had been fully up and running this year. Our schools, parents, teachers, governors, even pupils, seem to spend an inordinate amount of time fundraising in order to be able to provide basic materials, such as paper and pencils. The plaster on our classroom walls were kept in place by pupils' artwork and miles of sellotape. Our school libraries were dominated by empty shelves, very few books, and those books that were there, again, were being held together by the ubiquitous sellotape and offcuts from teachers' wallpaper used to bind those volumes so that they could at least hang together. But by far the most dramatic and heinous demonstration of Thatcherism was certainly not only in London, but across the whole country in metropolitan areas, where every single shop doorway, every single night, became the bedroom, the living room, the bathroom for the homeless. They grew in their thousands. And many of those homeless people had been thrown out onto the streets from the closure of the long-term mental hospitals. We were told it was going to be called, it was called, care in the community. What in effect it was no care at all in the community. I was interested to hear about Baroness Thatcher's willingness to invite those who had nowhere to go for Christmas. It's a pity she didn't start building more and more social houses after she entered into the right to buy. So perhaps there would have been fewer homeless people than there were. As a friend of mine said, during her era, London became a city Hogarth would have recognized, and indeed he would. But the basis to Thatcherism, and this is where I come to the spiritual part of what I regard as a desperate, desperately wrong track that the lead that Thatcherism took this country into, is that we were told that everything I had been taught to regard as a vice, and I still regard them as vices, under Thatcherism was in fact a virtue. Greed, selfishness, no care for the weaker, sharp elbows, sharp knees, they were the way forward. We heard much over, and will continue to hear over the next week, of the barriers that were broken down by Thatcherism, the establishment that was destroyed.
We can't take it.
What we actually saw, the word that has been circling around with stars around it, is that she created an aspirational society. It aspired for things. as indeed one of the former prime ministers, who himself had been elevated to the House of Lords, spoke about selling off the family silver. And people knowing under those years the price of everything and the value of nothing. What concerns me is that I am beginning to see possibly the re-emergence of that total traducing of what I regard as being the basis spiritual nature of this country, where we do care about society, where we do believe in communities, where we do not leave people to walk by on the other side. That isn't happening now. And if we go back to the heyday of that era, I think we will see replicated yet again the extraordinary human damage that we as a nation have suffered from, the talent that has been totally wasted because of the inability to genuinely see the individual value of every single human being. My honourable friend from Hackney referred to the fact that although she had differed with Lady Thatcher in her policies, she felt duty-bound to come to pay tribute to the first woman Prime Minister this country had produced. I am a generation who was raised by women. The men had all gone to war to defend our freedoms. They didn't just run a government, they ran a country. And the women that I knew, who raised me and millions of people like me, who ran our factories and our businesses, put out the fires when the bombs dropped, they would not have recognized their definition of womanliness as being incorporated an iconic model of Margaret Thatcher to pay tribute to the first prime minister deputed by female gender. Okay, but a woman, not on my terms.
Point of order, Sir Tony Baldry.
Mr. Speaker, the conventions of the House in respect of those occasions, rare occasions, on which the House chooses to make tributes to a person who has been deceased, are well established. This is not and has never been a general debate on the memory of the person who has been deceased, but an opportunity for tributes, not an opportunity for honourable members to denigrate the memory of the person who has been deceased.
Resume his seat. I'm grateful to the honourable gentleman for his, and I use the term advisedly, attempted point of order. Let me be explicit for the benefit both of the honourable gentleman and of the House. All honourable and right honourable members take responsibility for what they say in this place. The responsibility of the chair is to ensure that nothing unparliamentary occurs. Let me assure the honourable gentleman, for the avoidance of doubt, nothing unparliamentary has occurred. We are debating a motion that says that this House has considered the matter of tributes to the Baroness Thatcher.
Wake up, Maggie. I think I got something to say to you. It's late September, and I really should be back at my school. I know I keep you amused, but I feel I'm being used. Oh, Maggie, I couldn't try anymore. You led me away from my home just to save you from being alone. You stole my heart, but I love yous anyway.
Meanwhile, back in Brooklyn, Rocky Sullivan revelers were treated to a special appearance by Satan, Maggie's Bones, and Ronald Reagan, as channeled by political satirist and mayoral candidate Randy Credico, as introduced by John McDonough.
As we all know, Maggie Thatcher's BFF, LOL, see, I'm tweeting now, so come on. Her best friend was Ronald Reagan. The two of them are inseparable, even in death. We have with us today Ronald Reagan with the devil in hell and Maggie Thatcher in tow.